Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Hello, and welcome back to The Wonder, science-based paganism. I'm your host, Mark.
And I'm Yucca.
And today we are going to talk about the use of ritual practices for problem solving. Real, practical, get your hands dirty, make things happen in the world kind of ritual practices. So both Yucca and I have direct experience of doing that, and we feel like it's an important thing that we as pagans know how to do, and we want to talk about how it's done and give some examples and move on from there.
Yep. And we thought we'd kind of start with the big picture, the context of what we see ritual as and how it fits into our larger practice as pagans.
Yes. Yes. Would you like to start talking to that?
Sure. Well, we had started before hitting the record, kind of joking that this might be the closest to our spell episode that we might do. That our,
yes.
You know, what's our spell casting? So we've talked about ritual before and kind of why it's important. But what we're looking at today is a little bit more of the active problem solving, the choices that we're making, not just the passive things, not the what do we do on a daily basis, that not the behaviors that help us to feel more connected or things like that, but what do we do when we have a problem? What do we do when we want to enact change? And recognizing that we actually have the power to make changes in our own lives. You know, there are certain things that we don't have a lot of choice about, like that we're on a planet that's circulant, that's going around a sun and all of that. But in terms of how we are interacting with the people around us, how it feels to be us inside of us, and our response to the world, we've got a lot of power there. And the ritual is a tool to actually do something, to make change. And it's also something that I want to bring up from the very start, that is a skill that involves practice that one can develop. It's not like people are good, you know, naturally good at it or naturally bad at it. It's something that you can work on and develop and improve and see what works for you and go from there.
Yes, yes, very much so. As naturalist pagans, we don't believe in spooky action at a distance magic. You know, I do this ritual and then suddenly money comes to me or this person falls in love with me or whatever. But we do very strongly believe that ritual is a powerful toolkit for affecting our own consciousness and for working with the consciousness of other people who might come to us with a problem. Whether it's a conflict resolution problem between, you know, us and the other person, or whether it's just something in their life that they're really just not grappling with well and they want some guidance and support in that. I should emphasize this is always consensual, always, always, always. Mm-hmm. We don't want to do rituals about people who have not agreed to have that done, even though it won't have any effect on them if they don't know about it. It's just rude.
It's rude, yeah. Well, and
it's like talking about people when they're not around. It's just something that you shouldn't do.
Yeah. Well, and this, you know, this topic comes up, the idea of cursing and things like that comes up a lot in kind of the broader pagan community. And my take on it is that you're just making yourself feel crappy.
Yes.
Right? It's, and the way you behave towards that person might change in a maybe not so great way.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Sure. If you're going to stoke the fires of anger and resentment and feeling of victimhood, then guess what your experience is going to be? It's going to be exactly that. And there are people who kind of thrive on that sort of experience, but they're not very healthy people in my estimation. I have some personal experience of this, particularly with my mother. She liked to be a victim for the sake of the attention. Mm-hmm. And she was one of the most unhappy people I think I've ever known. And she really could have used somebody kind of giving her a good shake and saying, look, you know, you're fine, but this pattern is not serving you. It's just not, yes, it's getting you some attention, but pity is not what you want. That's not really love. It's pity.
Yeah.
So I think.
Well, ritual is one of those things that can help someone to make those changes.
Absolutely. Right?
Because we are very often very unaware of our patterns, and the ritual can help us to step out of that space and step back and take a look and then start to make some changes when we are in a different mindset, in a different space. So
yes, very much so. And one of the things about being a pagan and having ritual be an integrated part of our lives is that we develop experience and techniques and ideas and a sort of creative mindset around how to approach these psychological issues. So that if somebody comes to us all anxious and freaked out about something, and it's terrible and I can't solve it, and it's a crisis and it's never going to get any better and I'm doomed, we have the tools to work with somebody who's in that kind of a condition in order to sort of step them down, get them grounded, draw back for some perspective, understand where the strengths and resources are, get that this is not the end of the world, all those individual pieces. And those can be done in physical enactments, mm-hmm. not just, you know, saying words to someone, but in actual physical actions that involve the body and involve the even gravity. I'm going to tell a story later on that uses gravity in a major way to help someone.
Now, you say gravity, you're talking about gravity as in the fundamental force gravity?
The fundamental force gravity, absolutely. Yes.
All right, well, I'm curious to hear this now.
You know, the great thing about gravity is it's reliable.
Yep.
You can depend on gravity. Whatever your situation, gravity's going to be there.
Yep. Good thing, too.
Yes.
Most of the time.
Mostly, yeah.
Yeah. Like anything, we can come up with exceptions.
But. Sure. Well, I jumped out of an airplane once, and that was an unbelievable, amazing experience, and I'm really glad I did it. But there's definitely that moment where it crosses your mind, I'm not sure this gravity thing is such a great idea.
Wow. Well, that must have been an experience as well.
Wow. Your entire sensorium, like the dashboard of your brain, all lights up at once. Every warning light that you have says, no, 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 no. And then you're out of the plane and it's too late. And either you believe in parachutes, so have a great time, or you don't believe in parachutes and this is the end of your life, so have a great time. There's no stress anymore. Once your center of gravity leaves the plane, the crisis is over, and now it's just joy. It's so, so amazing.
Wow. Well, I think you're quite brave.
I don't like heights, actually. That's part of why I did it, because I'm really not fond of heights.
Nice. So it was wonderful. Well, we should come back to that story again.
Okay, someday.
It fascinates me. It kind of terrifies me, but fascinates me. So. Yeah,
it is terrifying, but it's also fascinating, yes. So, we're pagans. We do rituals. Some of those rituals are just about the bodily and psychological enactment of our relationship with living. So that's your daily practice and your Wheel of the Year celebrations around the course of the seasons and your holiday feasts and your maypole dance and all those kinds of things. But then there are the other times, which are not programmed. They're not scheduled. They just come into your life. And we are fortunate in that because we're pagans, we are given permission to do stuff to help ourselves in a way that people in the mainstream culture really aren't. Mm-hmm. I mean, particularly people who are devout Christians, you know, any of that kind of stuff, that's dabbling with devil's work. You can't, you know, all these ritual sorts of things, even for some of the very conservative ones, even psychotherapy mm-hmm. is, you know, this satanic intervention between themselves and God, right? The only solution to every problem is to pray.
Yeah. Now, there are, so that's a kind of a very extreme level, but for a lot of the mainstream culture, that authority has been given to therapists and counselors. And not to say that there isn't tremendous value in what they do, but the individual also, I think the individual gets left out of the broader conversation and in what we can do for ourselves or what we can do for our friends. Like you were talking earlier about who might come to us or our partners or family members.
Yes. Yes, I think so. And I think that there are two harms that cause. The first one is that there is a role for community in supporting and healing its members that shouldn't be shunted off to a professional, even though professionals are great. And if someone, I mean, to be honest, if someone comes to me and they're saying, I'm hearing voices all the time and they're telling me to do crazy things, then my answer is you need to go and talk to a professional because that very clearly is a psychosis. On the other hand, if somebody comes to me and says, I just have this weight on me all the time, I feel like I'm in this black cloud and I'm alone and nobody's going to help me, I can help with that. They may need professional help as well, but I can definitely help with that feeling of being alone and under that weight. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we as humans should feel some responsibility to do that. And in our mainstream culture, that isn't quite how it gets looked at. I mean, we are not very far away, let's be clear, from the days when admitting that you even saw a therapist was seen as a real blow to your credibility and your standing in the community. And there are still more conservative segments of our society where that's very true.
Yeah, it's seen as a weakness.
Yes.
Or worse.
Or a moral failing, even worse, yes.
Yeah.
So that's great news. We do these rituals, and one of the things about our Wheel of the Year is that we get to practice a bunch. Mm-hmm. And we have our daily practices, and we have our seasonal practices. And so we tend to think in metaphors and symbols. We tend to think in terms of, well, here's what we're celebrating at this time of the year. How do I enact that with my body and with plants or objects or symbols? How do I do something that speaks to that moment that's happening in our time? And once you get in the habit of that kind of thinking, you can do it for people who have a challenge or for yourself if you have a challenge.
Yeah. And that is so human. We are just learning to speak the language of that kind of deeper part of ourselves.
Yes. Yes. I am often struck by the strange disjuncture in Western civilization where on the one hand we do some things so much better than really any other culture out there in terms of sort of prosecuting technology to its absolute limits of possibility, and you know, driving economic efficiencies and those kinds of things, which have many downsides, but let's be honest, they have many upsides for us as well. They've done a lot of things for us. Mm-hmm. But then we've abandoned these mountains of lore and technology that other people have just about being human and about how to help one another and be happy and have lives that feel meaningful. It's just the oddest thing in the world. It's like we abandoned so much of our humanity in order to build a really great machine.
Yeah. Well, the ritual is something that we can do to rekindle that.
Very much so.
We've been talking a lot about the benefit, the why. Do we want to get into the actual rituals and techniques a little bit?
Sure. Sure. To me, the first step is diagnostic. The person, whether it's myself or a partner or a friend, whoever it is that I'm working with, what I want to hear is, what's the story? Mm-hmm. You know, close your eyes, tell me what it feels like. And it doesn't matter if it doesn't come out in complete sentences, and if it's in broken images, that's great, because that's really getting at what you're contending with. If you genuinely feel like your head is in a cloud and you're under a giant rock, then we're going to do a ritual about getting your head out of a cloud and you out from under a giant rock. Mm-hmm. I want to tell a story about a ritual that I did for my ex-wife, who is a lovely person. She's just not lovely for me. But we're friends. I see her on a Zoom call every Friday, because she's part of my ritual circle. And this was a time where something terrible happened in her work life, and she was feeling tremendous anxiety around money and survival and all this stuff. And I should preface this by saying that she was very anxiety prone to begin with, very sort of thin, frail, bird-like, kind of hummingbird sort of feel to her, which changed a great deal when she started eating fish after 16 years of being a vegetarian. Mm-hmm. She had a real transformation in terms of her sense of groundedness and her kind of feeling of solidity in herself.
Yeah, but this you hear that a lot.
Yeah. But this was at the time that hadn't happened yet. Mm. And I mean, literally looking at her and listening to the story of what was happening, I could see her fluttering around the room, you know, like up in the air, flitting about like a bat caught inside a house. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay, well, let's do something about that. And of course she went on into the, but there's nothing to be done because da 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 da. And I sat her down cross-legged, and I have I don't have this rock anymore. It's a piece of serpentine stone that I plucked out of a creek bed during a big storm. So there was water just raging all over it. And this stone weighed 20 pounds, something like that. So I took this rock and I plunked it into her lap. And she immediately began to laugh and said, "That's great. That's so great. Thank you." Mm-hmm. And we went on to work from there, but this is the story about gravity, right? I used gravity to pin her from fluttering all around the room to being rooted in place, so that we could actually then tease apart, okay, what are you afraid of? And what part of that is something you have control over, and what part of it isn't? And what part of it is maybe real, and what part of it is maybe catastrophizing and, you know, seeing the worst case scenario. And we were able to have a very, very powerful ritual and conversation after that. But plunking that stone into her lap changed everything. And is one of the clearest examples that I have in my memory of how very simple ritual techniques can just make a huge difference for people.
Yeah. So that was, it was symbolic on a kind of that mental level, right? But also she got to experience that in her body, actually feel that weight on her lap, have something physical. So that's a, one doesn't have to have physical tools, but sometimes, like what you've just described, they can be incredibly helpful to have that real physical thing.
They can indeed. And if I hadn't had the rock, we would have gone outside and I would have found some bare dirt and I would have asked her to like take off her shoes, put her bare feet, bare hands on the ground and just breathe.
Yeah.
You know, get the, get that connected, calm sort of geological time sense that you get when you do that.
Yeah.
But I think the rock worked better. The rock was pretty good.
Yeah. Well, and just touching back quickly to something that you said before, that the consent issue is very important at this. It sounds like what you're describing was a, you were, there was trust and consent in this. This wasn't something that you did to her without her permission, right? You guys were working together.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I said, well, would you like to do something about this? And of course she was very skeptical because that's the mindset when you think that nothing can be done and there's a terrible crisis and it's all over and nothing will ever be good again. Right. And we've all been in that state at one time or another.
And that's the curtain that you just got to get past, right? Right. Or bypass that, get past that. Right.
Exactly. So, and then, okay, well, we're going to do something about this and here, hold this.
Yeah.
And honestly, I had thought of that as sort of a preamble. You know, let's get some grounding in here first. Mm-hmm. And then we'll kind of move on from there. But it made such a profound effect that it became kind of the centerpiece of the ritual work that we did that day. Mm. So, yeah. How about you? How about an example of when you've like done some problem solving for yourself or someone else?
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I didn't do any brainstorming on that before we started. So I'm sure I could come up with specific stories, but I'd have to really think about it.
Maybe a conflict resolution situation or something like that?
Yeah, well, I've definitely used going into a ritual space in order to work out some pretty heavy conflict before, right? Having both of us actually using the form of casting a circle and creating space that way and stepping in and going, okay, we are outside of our normal experience right now and we're gonna agree on some ground rules. So that's really, really important when doing conflict resolution as having some ideas about what's fair, right? And people come from very different backgrounds about what they consider to be fair or not. I have a very, for me, it's, I think it's so important to not tell the other person what they think or believe. I find that to be incredibly disrespectful, invasive, and simply not true. How could you possibly know what the other person, right? You could say things like, you know, my guess is, or it seems like, but so anyways, having those ground rules, those establish what we are agreeing upon it is okay. And what is our goal, starting with the goal before going into something like that. But once in a ritual, it's something that I find very helpful, and it sounds like this was maybe done a little bit with your stone example, is to have something that lets your brain know that this is different and you need to remember.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing with the stone experience, having that, it was a new experience to have that stone on the lap. And the brain would have been paying much more attention than it would otherwise. And so you can have symbols like that, but there's also things you can do, you know, this kind of, you might hear the lacing your fingers trick, where if you go ahead right now, if you're not driving and you can actually do this with your hands, go ahead and lace your fingers together, and you will almost always put your fingers the same way. You just have a habit, right? It may be, for me, my left thumb is always on the top, but if I shift it and put my right thumb on the top, I wonder if that's something about being right or left dominant. Like that'd be an interesting, but anyways, shift it. And something feels a little bit off about it. Mm-hmm. As long as you don't use it too often. Once you start using it too often, that changes the situation. But it's different enough that your brain pays attention on a very deep level behind that consciousness. Or doing something, being in a different, in a strange position, right? Standing on one leg, or putting your tongue on the top of your mouth, or doing something when you are enacting or visualizing the change that you want to occur, or working through those problems, just so that you're going to be remembering it on a deeper level. And so when I've done conflict resolution within the circle, within the ritual space, when we've come to a solution, then we've purposely done something where we get in some weird position or something like that, and then talk through that solution. So, and then
what I'm hearing, it's interesting because it seems as though there's now sort of a structure emerging. Mm-hmm. There is the diagnostic and consent piece to start with, and then there's changing the context, you know, flipping the story in some way, in a physical sense, whether it's the rock in your lap or the strange way of interlacing your fingers or being in an unusual position, something that tells your body, okay, this isn't the same context that we were in when we were panicking. Mm-hmm. We were furious. This is a different kind of space. And now we're going to explore what we can find here.
Yeah. And it's going to look different, right? When I've done conflict resolution with other people, it usually involves words. When I do it within myself, I'm not a very verbal person. It's not a verbal experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost hard to describe, but it exists on a level that isn't verbal. It's feelings and space and color and symbols, and it's just a different experience, right? But I do see the structural idea that you're talking about. Yeah, I would very much agree with that.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, creating the strangeness, the difference, kind of opens the door to the possibility of change.
Mm-hmm.
It says, all right, we're not in the trap we were in before, and now there are opportunities. And so that then becomes the moment when you can start sort of working with the individual messages. You know, you feel this about me. Well, actually, no, I don't. But I was sure that you said that. No, here's what I really feel. You can start to sort of tease apart the pieces in a way that's calm and reassuring.
Mm-hmm.
Because in many cases, when people come to you in crisis, what they most want is reassurance more than anything else. They want to know that they're going to be safe and okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and the being, at least for me, I think that being in the ritual space, that's such a powerful place that it has to be safe for me to be able to do that level of emotional work. And if it's not, I'm not going to be able to. That part beyond the thinking me will protect myself and not let myself go there unless it has the trust that it's going to be okay.
Yes. So having done that, then having entered into a space of relative calm after the sort of uproar that potentiated the event in the first place, what I find is that towards the closing of that, it's very helpful to have some sort of a symbol or a token that the person can then, and that can be anything. I mean, it could be a finger mudra of some kind, some sort of, you know, shape that they make with their finger to remind themselves of this state that they've been in, or it can be a physical token, or it can be, you know, when you see Orion, remember that this is
the, so it's a key.
Yes. Some kind of a key that takes you back to that space and gives you renewed access to what you've learned and achieved during that ritual accomplishment. I know that for myself, those kinds of things mean a great deal. I carry a pocket full of little talismans from moments in my life and times when I've been with the community that I love, and objects that remind me about just how amazing everything is and that kind of stuff. And having something like that, that I can fish out of my pocket and look at, makes a big difference. Really makes a big difference to me.
I would imagine that that would be a type of thing that might, at least for a time, have a place on one's focus or altar.
Yes.
We discussed those recently. Yeah.
I kind of think of my right front pants pocket as my pocket focus. it didn't start that way. It just started with one or two objects, but now I think there are about 12. And they're all very small, and they sort of jingle and that kind of thing. That's fine. But I feel better when I have them.
Yeah.
I feel like I've kind of brought my whole gang along. And that's why ritual behavior is useful to us, right? It's not that those items themselves have any particular magical power in the world, but each one of them has a story. And the story is one that I find empowering and reassuring. And so when I bring my stories with me, I feel safer, more powerful, more confident.
Yeah. Well, and for those listening who are kind of mulling over what this might look like in their own life, it might not be an object, right? Mm-hmm. The object works very well for you, but maybe for them, it might be a melody, right? That could be, that could be hummed, or a place. Maybe a place that you go to in your mind, one of your power spots, or perhaps a literal space as well, literal place that you could literally go to. But I would encourage also having something that you could do anywhere, right? Because you're not always going to have access to being able to go to the special spot. But it could be really, as long as it brings you back to that state or reminds you of that state, reminds you of that, then it could be something that would work.
And there is a technique that you can use in guided visualization where you embed something into your body so that it's with you all the time. One of the earliest guided visualizations I ever did, which was in this kind of new agey sort of workshop thing that I went to, and we went to this garden, and of course everybody has their own garden, and it's wonderful, and it's walled and it's safe and all that. And then there are these sort of luminous beings that are there to give you wisdom and tell you things, right, that are helpful. And what they gave me was this emblem representing adventure. and sank it into my upper left arm. And it's been there ever since. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't even really revisit this garden very much because, to be honest, there are real world places that I would prefer to go on my internal journeys, mm-hmm. that I find more magical than the kind of new age thing with the shining people and stuff. But that periapt of adventure, has stayed with me, and I find that it's something that I can draw on over and over again. So even, you know, much less having to be a physical object, it can be simply a place in your body which has had some sort of special attention paid to it at the time of this ritual and given a meaning. Mm-hmm. And that's a very powerful technique. I mean, the workshop that I'm talking about happened 35 years ago, something like that, a long time ago, and it sticks in my mind. I keep it in mind.
Mm. Well, I don't know if this is something you do, but if someone did something like that, then the act of maybe touching that spot,
yes,
would be something that would bring that back.
Yes, and there have been times in my life when I felt pretty flat and pretty dispirited, and when I've thought, you know, this is all very prosaic and I'm not having a very good time. And then I've remembered, but I'm an adventurer. And I've had many adventures, and I've always come out of these flat spots and gone into new sorts of adventures. So, you know, having that embedded into my physicality has been very meaningful for me. And I think that's something that we can do for people that we're helping as well. Mm-hmm. Even if it's as simple as patience or, 10 seconds before reacting. Anything like that.
But neither of those sound very simple to me. Those sound, those are quite tasks, important ones, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, if I had 10 seconds before reacting embedded into the back of my right hand, I'll tell you it would be much more, maybe I should do that.
But, yeah, we have these great things called tattoos.
That's true.
Very powerful.
That's very true.
Yeah.
I don't have any of those. I think about it now and again. When I do, the first thing I'll get is an Aethiopagan sun tree.
Mm.
That'll be the symbol that I'll have. But yes, 10 seconds.
Meaningful and beautiful on its own.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, to me, it speaks not only of my relationship to the world, but this community that I've worked to bring about, and everything about it is just really moving to me. Mm. So where are we in our list of things?
Well, we've been talking about some of the actual tools within the tool set. So are there any others that you would like to touch on?
Other than a big rock?
Other than a big rock, yeah.
Oh, you can definitely change someone's consciousness with a big rock.
yeah, in more ways than one.
Yeah, you can actually end someone's consciousness with a big rock.
Remember, we said that consent is important here.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Never mind. Yeah. Scratch that. well, I mean, I have a Focus that's a bookcase. Mm-hmm. And I took out one of the shelves so that it's a double high space. Mm-hmm. And that is the world. It's life. It's all the symbols and things that are meaningful and exciting and moving and reminiscent to me. And then the shelf below that is the underworld, which is the place of the honored dead and ancestry and evolution and bones and skulls and cave paintings and all that kind of stuff. The bottom two shelves are where I store gear, wands and fancy bottles full of water from storms and water from high up in the Grand Tetons and various, you know, jars and things full of incense. And it's all very witchy and very attractive. I just really love looking at it. All of those kinds of things. The reason that I have all that stuff is so that when the moment comes to hand and there is a need for a thing, Like if somebody really needs the kind of patience that the ocean has, well, I have a wand that's made of kelp. It's dried bullwhip kelp. And that's what I will grab and that's what I will use. And I will make sure that they know that that's what I'm using, that it's a wand delivered by the ocean up onto the land and given to me, and that that's what I use. Different kinds of scents. That's actually something that can be very powerful because the olfactory sense goes so deep into our experience. If you do a process with someone and you're burning a particular kind of incense during that, give them some. Let them get back to that experience by re-experiencing the smell that you produce during that ritual. You know, there are all these little techniques. You can anoint someone with an essential oil that has a particular scent and that might be tingly if it's fir or cypress or something like that, peppermint. There are so many options for ways we can use ritual tools, which can mean, I mean, I've used a Swiss Army knife as a ritual tool. I've used a Leatherman tool as a ritual tool because somebody needed a lot of different tools in order to get through the situation that they were in. So it was like, here, you should have my Swiss Army knife. You're navigating a very complicated situation. Why don't you just take this and hold on to it until you don't need it anymore? And that was very meaningful to them. And so it became more of a ritual object than a literal tool. That's great. That's exactly the kind of thing to be thinking about. It's a very creative kind of process. But it's also one that is so, as you say, so human.
Yeah.
I'm going to say something else, but I don't remember what it was.
So I want to come back to the form a little bit because we've been talking about the things that we can do in there. But I think that it's really important to, so we enter into the state, but I think it's very important to also close the ritual, to close the experience and have it so that that state of hyper learning that our body is in stops where you want it to stop, and you aren't just going on and exhausting yourself, because this is an intense process. When you've opened yourself up to that, it can be exhausting. And then if you don't close that, then it's like not closing up a wound, right? You want to cover that up or protect it in some way.
Right. Very, very well said. I mean, at the beginning of a ritual like this, the establishment of safety, containment of some kind, whether it's drawing a circle or whatever it is, but that sense of being in a place where change can happen because you're safe and you're not going to be attacked in any way is so important. At the end of that process, the closure and the reestablishment of normal time becomes very important. And if it's been a really intense process, you need to do stuff that will physically ground you. You need to eat a solid meal, take a shower maybe, or a bath, go outside, put your feet on the ground, take some deep breaths. What you don't want to do is to get behind the wheel of a car or go rushing back out to the situation that was challenging you without some kind of a grounding process before.
Yeah.
That's a very good point. I call that sort of thing ritual hygiene. I made a terrible mistake once when I published a bunch of stuff about rituals to the Atheopaganism blog and neglected that step. This was for the Atheopaganism U online course that that people
you take. As in university
you as in university yeah. Yeah, that people take, which, by the way, there's another session of coming up starting September 12th, so if people are interested in taking that course, they should go to atheopaganism.org and go to the contact page and send me an email to ask about it. And what I did was I assigned people to do a starting ritual. And a couple of them had very powerful experiences and then were way out in space. And I had not prescribed the ritual hygiene pieces of coming back down and getting back into normal space. And it was, I mean, they were okay, but it was a real mistake. And it's something that I pay attention to now.
Well, and there's a lot of different practices that incorporate that from traditions all over the world. Mm-hmm. You know, people have different feelings about TM meditation, but that's an example of one that when they teach you, you've got your rest period after, you know, they have a very specific number of minutes that you're supposed to do after you come back to your normal state of where they stress that this is so, so important. If you skip this, then you're basically, you might as well not have done the meditation in the first place.
Hmm.
You have to have your breathing to come back and transition between the two states.
Interesting. So I wasn't aware of that. That's that's very wise.
Yeah. And thinking about, different Protestant traditions when they, you know, leaving the service, there's a song at the end and, you know, there's a closure to everything.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of, you know, it's a wisdom that a lot of people have picked up on or practiced. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So I would be really interested in hearing from our listeners about what kinds of experiences they have had with transformational rituals that have helped them with challenging situations, conflict resolution, any of those kinds of things, and what sorts of techniques were used in order to accomplish that.
Mm-hmm.
You can email us at thewonderpodcastqs@gmail.com. That's thewonderpodcastqs@gmail.com. And we would love to be able to read some of your experiences out on the air. Let us know if you're comfortable with that when you do send mail. Mm-hmm. And we're also, I should mention, we're getting ready to do sort of a mailbag episode where we'd like to kick around questions and comments and ideas that come from the listenership. And we know that you're out there because we can see that thousands of people have downloaded this podcast. So don't stay quiet. Come back to us and, let us know what you think. Let us know what you're curious about or what you like to hear us talk about. And we will do that. So,
Are there certain types of episodes that we do that you like or ones that we haven't done yet? You know, that kind of thing.
Right. Right. Exactly.
And of course, your specific comments or questions or themes. So, yeah.
Yeah, that would be really great. So once again, Yucca, this has been a terrific conversation. I so enjoy talking with you about these things. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mark. Okay, well, see you next week.
Bye-bye, folks.